Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The Supreme Court is winding down its current term, and decisions are rolling in. One case, Gamble v. U.S., was decided on Monday, and it's caught the eye of court watchers because it had liberal and conservative judges seemingly arguing against their own past positions. And it ripped open the old debate about whether to interpret the Constitution as a living document. All major issues in a case about the notion of double jeopardy, whether a person can be tried twice for the same crime. So this hour on Point, the Supreme Court and the case of Terrence Gamble. And you can join us. Do you think a person should be tried twice for the same crime in state and then federal court? The Gamble case also wrestles with the idea of precedent. So how closely should justices adhere to rulings that have come before? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And a little later this hour, we'll also take a look at some other key cases the court heard this term, including that citizenship question case and gerrymandering as well. But first, to Gamble v. U.S. And joining me to explain is Josh Gerstein, senior legal affairs contributor to Politico. We have links to his stories on the Supreme Court at onpointradio.org. Josh, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Meghna. Great to be back with you.
It's great to have you back. Also with us from Denver is Ian Farrell. He teaches constitutional law at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. Professor Farrell, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me on.
So first of all, Josh, just give us a quick cliff notes on the Gamble case here. What was the basis of Terrence Gamble's objection to his criminal history, and how did this case end up in the Supreme Court?
So Terrence Gamble is located out of Alabama, and he had pled guilty to an offense down there of being a felon in possession of a firearm. After he pled guilty to that offense in Alabama court, federal prosecutors came in and again, under the federal court and through the federal court system, charged him with being a felon in possession of a firearm, which is something like many kinds of crimes. It's illegal under state law and under federal law. And so he pled guilty to that second federal case. But as he was pleading guilty, he lodged a constitutional objection. And his argument was essentially that it violated the Constitution's double jeopardy clause, which says that you should not be put in jeopardy of life or limb for the same offense more than once. And folks have probably heard of that. Mm-hmm. The tricky part here is that for nearly 200 years, the Supreme Court has said that prosecutions by the state government and the federal government, regardless of which one goes first, don't violate that clause. It's called the dual sovereignty principle. And it basically says that each of those sovereigns, the state government and the federal government, gets a shot at you if you violate their laws.
Okay.
And Mr. Gamble's lawyers said that they disagreed with that principle. They thought it was a misinterpretation of the Constitution. And that's the way they took it to the Supreme Court.
So Ian Farrell, we'll talk specifically about what the justices wrote in their 7-2 decision and sort of the strange bedfellows, especially on the dissenting side here with Justice Ginsburg and Gorsuch in the dissent. But to Josh's point, Professor Farrell, I think people have frequently had the presumption that you can't face double jeopardy in a court for the same crime at the state level. But how frequently do we see these cases being tried both at the state and federal level? Is it a common occurrence?
So as the justices point out in a couple of the different opinions, it's not that common. One of the points that I believe Justice Ginsburg points out is that this wouldn't overturn, if they had overturned the earlier precedent and prohibited this charging in succession by the state and federal governments, it would not affect a lot of cases. And I think the numbers that they refer to or that she refers to are somewhere in the low hundreds. But it's worth pointing out that Justice is absolutely right in everything he said. It's worth pointing out that even putting aside this dual sovereignty principle, there are substantial limitations on the double jeopardy principle in that, for example, it's still possible even by either the state government or the federal government to charge multiple offences for the same conduct. So, for example, if you resist arrest, you could be charged with resisting arrest, obstructing a police officer, and assaulting an officer because they're slightly different offences. There are a lot of issues with sort of overcharging, but I believe that the justices are correct to the extent that this is a relatively small number of cases. And
right.
So I think the comments that both you and Josh made earlier about what's really interesting about this case in terms of it extending beyond the facts of the case and the dual sovereignty
yeah.
principle itself is how do we deal with precedent?
Mm-hmm.
I think
mm-hmm.
that really is the key. I think you're absolutely right about that.
So Josh, let me come back to you on that, because I'm looking here at Justice Samuel Alito, who wrote for the majority here, right? He wrote that the historical evidence assembled by Gamble is feeble. And then he says, pointing the other way, meaning in the direction of the majority ruling, I guess, are the clause's text, other historical evidence, and 170 years of precedent. So, I mean, is that Justice Alito saying that it's the precedent here that carries heavier weight than what may be written in the Constitution?
Yeah, and it is this fight about, sort of what I think is the predominant philosophy on the Supreme Court at the moment called originalism. And, the fact that originalism doesn't really give you the answers in every single case. I mean, sometimes you go and you look at the historical record and it's either ambiguous or somewhat silent, or different people can weigh it different ways. Even if one agrees that the task is to look at the words and maybe to look at what their meaning was at the time the Constitution was written, that doesn't always get you there. And there still often are disputes. And this is one of these cases where you see justices who would consider themselves to be originalist and who sort of ideologically are in similar spot, like Samuel Alito, who wrote the majority opinion, and Neil Gorsuch, who wrote one of the dissenting opinions, and they come to two different results on how they assess it. And this factor that Ian was mentioning of how precedent figures into this and how much we should rely on the fact that for nearly two centuries, the Supreme Court has held this dual sovereignty principle and allowed these kinds of successive prosecutions. How much weight should the court give that? And how significant is that principle? Maybe if you extend it to other cases like Roe v. Wade, should an opinion like that be left on the books in significant part because it's been on the books for a long time?
I do want to explore that further because it's kind of the heart of the matter here. But before we move fully away from this dual sovereignty issue, Ian Farrell, let's understand this a little bit more, because, you know, Justice Alito, as Josh was saying, has written that he sees, or the court sees, the majority sees state and federal government as independent sovereigns. And then he even uses the example of if a U.S. citizen were to commit a crime internationally, that person would be likely tried in the foreign country, but also potentially tried in the United States. Again, dual sovereigns there. But is that really is that an apt metaphor? So clearly, the United States and a foreign country are independent sovereigns of one another, but is the federal government and the state government sufficiently independent to make that argument?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I certainly had the same reaction to the analogy with, or the comparison to, the U.S. and a separate sovereign. So I think that you could draw a line and say that you're allowed the U.S. federal government or U.S. state government is permitted to try someone even though they've been tried by a separate sovereign, and still prohibit both the federal and state government from prosecuting in succession. The argument that Justice Alito gives is a pretty technical argument. So he says, look, we use the word offense in the text of the Fifth Amendment. It says that you can't be tried for the same offense twice. And he says, well, what is an offense? Well, an offense is a violation of a law. And what is a law? A law is something that's created by a sovereign, and the state government has sovereignty and the federal government has sovereignty. And so an offence created by each of them is technically different, and therefore you're not being tried for the same offence twice. I think that the dissenters have a fairly compelling response to that. So Justice Ginsburg, for instance, says, well, really, in the U.S. system, it's the people who are sovereign.
Right.
And so it is merely a different aspect of the people's sovereignty to be tried by the federal government and the state government. So it's not really a separate sovereign, certainly not in the same way that, for instance, the sovereignty of Germany is a completely separate sovereign.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, it's quite different to be tried by an entirely different sovereign than to be tried first by part of the U.S. sovereignty and then by the whole of the U.S. sovereignty and vice versa.
Right. And let me just jump in here. And Josh, we've got a minute to go before we have to take a quick break here. And it was Justice Ginsburg, as Ian Farrell is pointing out, and Justice Gorsuch in the dissent, sort of kind of cutting across to traditional liberal and conservative lines here. Is that, were you surprised by the two of them being in the dissent together?
Well, they wrote separate dissents, but I'm not terribly surprised, because sometimes on these issues of civil liberties, you do see people at both end of the spectrum alarmed about things that people more towards the center of the spectrum don't get as upset about. I'm not at all surprised, say, that Justice Alito came out in favor of law enforcement and prosecution in this case, because it's been said that he's never ruled for a criminal defendant in any of his cases on the court. That may be not quite be true, but he certainly has a very pro-government view in these matters. So it is interesting to see the two, the liberal justice and the very conservative Justice Gorsuch, line up and expressing similar concerns.
Well, Josh Gerstein and Ian Farrell, stand by for just a moment. We are talking about a big case that the U.S. Supreme Court decided on Monday. It's called Gamble v. U.S. And when we come back, we'll talk about its implication for the idea of precedent at the U.S. Supreme Court, and also for presidential pardons as well. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about Gamble v. U.S. It's a very interesting case that the United States Supreme Court issued a decision on Monday, a 7-2 decision that upholds the idea that someone can be tried twice in state and federal court for the same crime. We're also going to explore the implications of this case for the idea of precedents in the United States Supreme Court, and then also the implications for presidential pardons. I'm joined today by Josh Gerstein. He's senior legal affairs contributor to Politico, and Ian Farrell is also with us. He teaches constitutional law at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. And let's listen to Justice Neil Gorsuch Justice Neil Gorsuch during oral argument for the Gamble case last December. And in this moment, during oral argument, he asked the attorney representing the United States government about the separate sovereigns doctrine.
Before we get to more examples, I thought Justice Ginsburg's point was worth exploring a little bit more. I had thought in this country the people were the sovereign, and that sovereignty was divided, exercise of sovereignty was divided, not multiplied. So it was divided between the federal government and the state governments, Ninth and Tenth Amendment. And that it is awkward, isn't it, to say that there are two sovereigns who get to multiply offenses against you.
That's Justice Neil Gorsuch during oral argument in the Gamble case last December. Ian Farrell, can you help just decipher the judicial language that the justice is using there? I mean, was he sort of shedding some light on what his perspective was about whether or not you can claim that state and federal governments are separate sovereign entities?
Absolutely. And so the metaphor is often used of like that when the U.S. federal government was formed, there was a splitting of the atom of sovereignty, so that previously sovereignty had been considered entirely unitary. But with a federal system, you have some splitting or sharing of sovereign power and responsibility. Now, as the dissenters point out, the one of the main justifications for having a federal system is that having both the state and federal government and limitations on those state and federal governments in the amendments to the Constitution were meant to doubly protect individual interests and individual rights and so forth. And so I was really struck by Justice Gorsuch's language of division and multiplication, right?
Yeah.
So this view of dual sovereignty, instead of doubly protecting individuals, allows them to be doubly charged and prosecuted. And so that seems to be at odds with the notion of federalism as a dual mm-hmm. protection. And it certainly did indicate what his position would be in his opinion.
I see. Well, let's take a quick call here. Let's go to Brian, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Brian, you're on the air.
Thanks, Meghna. So I just have a quick question. What about if a city or a county also wanted to prosecute? At what point in time could somebody be charged even four times for the same thing?
Brian, thanks for your question. Josh Gerstein, you have an answer for Brian?
I don't know the specific answer to that, although I think that usually these offenses usually tend to be a little bit different at each level. And so in a city or county, you might be prosecuted for violating a local ordinance. And as Ian was saying earlier, some things you might do might violate that local ordinance and state law and maybe federal law. And I don't think that there would be much of a obstacle to prosecuting you in those different forums. But it does start to bring us towards the issue of whether states are entitled to add safeguards that the Constitution doesn't require, which is a bit closer to the begins to get into this issue of the Trump pardons and whether states should tinker with their rules on this issue in order to try to blunt the impact of President Trump's ability to pardon some of his colleagues or former colleagues or even family members for things they might have done.
Right. So we keep teasing listeners with this with the idea that we're going to talk about pardons, and we will. But let's first just go to Stacy, who's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Stacy, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. My question comes actually from the perspective of a high school government teacher, and we teach that, you know, the Constitution is the law of the land and that it is superior to all state laws. So how then can we reconcile that we have a criminal justice system that has both state and federal laws being applied to the same offense when our actual laws, you know, states are not, you know, although we're kind of seeing this with marijuana legalization, states can't have laws that are contradictory to the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah, Stacey, it's a great question and one of the sort of the central issues here. Thank you so much for your call. Ian Farrell, would you like to respond to her?
Yeah, that is a great question. Thanks, Stacey. So there are a couple of different issues there. One is whether or not the state law is in conflict with the federal constitution, and the other is whether the state law is in contradiction to other federal law. So with the marijuana legalization in various states, including where I am in Colorado, there really is this tension between the state law and the federal law. But with respect to the Constitution itself, the federal Constitution clearly is superior to both federal statutory law and state statutory law. So what's happening in this case is that the Supreme Court isn't saying that the federal Constitution defers to this state law and federal law. Rather, they're saying that the proper understanding, based on, according to Justice Alito and Justice Gorsuch and Justice Thomas, for instance, who also wrote a concurrence, they're saying the proper understanding based on the original intent or the original meaning allows this. So it's not that the state law trumps, but rather it isn't prohibited by the admittedly superior federal law.
Uh-huh. Okay. So Josh Gerstein and Ian Farrell, let's turn our attention a little bit to these other corollary issues that the Gamble case raises. First and foremost, many people were wondering, prior to this decision coming down, would this case have an impact on a president's ability to issue pardons? So Josh, sort of parse that out for us. Why were people asking that question?
Well, people were asking that question. Obviously, there's this lingering issue of whether President Trump might try to pardon anybody involved in the Mueller investigation. And he hasn't said one way or another committed on that question. And some folks believe that people like Paul Manafort, for example, may have refused to implicate the president or give information damaging to him because there's some kind of tacit wink and nod, or at least a hope on his part, that he would get a pardon down the road. Now, one of the potential checks on that kind of a pardon is the possibility, in theory, that Manafort, well, it's not just a theory in Manafort's case, but that any of those people might face state charges. The president can't pardon you on state charges. And so if you admitted to, say, a bank fraud in federal court, and for some reason your federal prosecution went away, the state would be free to come in and prosecute you again. Now, if this case at the Supreme Court, Gamble, had come out differently, maybe the state wouldn't be free to come in and prosecute you again because you got a pardon or a commutation. So these were the issues people were looking at prior to this case in terms of whether the Supreme Court's decision, if they overturned this dual sovereignty doctrine, might have made it harder for states to jump in on sort of the tail end of the Mueller investigation.
Right. So, Ian Farrell, we're left with the status quo then on that. No change in terms of who a president may be able to pardon.
Yeah, that's right. Although I also think that had the decision gone the other way, in other words, had they overturned the dual sovereignty principle, that wouldn't necessarily have prevented states from charging someone like Paul Manafort with crimes, even if he's been pardoned by the president, because as both Josh and I mentioned earlier, the definition of an offense really is fairly strict and narrow. So if the charges by the state governments were even just a tiny little bit different, requiring one fact that has to be proved under the state law that doesn't have to be proved under the federal law, the person could still be charged again. So, So I wasn't thinking about this as something that would, even if it had gone the other way, completely prevented the states from charging someone who had been pardoned or had their sentence commuted, et cetera, by the president. But certainly, as things stand, the status quo with regard to the dual sovereignty principle remains, and there is certainly more freedom for the state governments to charge someone, prosecute someone, even if they've been or will be pardoned by the president.
Does this case then reach into to the level that where states retain the freedom to not just charge people, but perhaps pass laws that are either contrary or superseding federal law?
Right. So there's a slightly different issue there,
yeah,
as to whether or not states can pass laws that are inconsistent with federal law. And so there's a principle of constitutional law that says that if there is a conflict between state law and federal law, it's the federal law that prevails.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are a lot of complicated and technical doctrines as to, well, what constitutes a conflict.
Right. Okay.
Right. And so that would have to be looked at. So, for example, if the federal government prohibits a certain kind of conduct and the state government prohibits exactly the same conduct but has a different level of punishment, that would not be considered a conflict and the state law would not be prohibited as a result.
I see. Okay. So, Josh Gerstein, one last area of analysis here in the Gamble case, and this actually might be the one that fascinates me the most. And again, I'm just referencing Justice Alito's pointing to 170 years of precedent that's undergirding the majority decision that he wrote. So is this the court once again upholding the sanctity of precedent, or stare decisis, I guess, as it's called, in the high court? Because I'm also seeing that people are looking at this case wondering if it's setting the stage for the court to more often ignore precedents. And I don't quite understand that.
Well, it certainly does seem to stand as a tribute to the notion of stare decisis and the notion that the court's precedents should be considered a significant weight on the scale. But it's not totally definitive on that question. They still go through the historical record. It's not as if they say just because we've ruled this way in the past, that's the only reason we're going to stick with this dual sovereignty rule in double jeopardy cases. But you did have Justice Clarence Thomas come in here, and he devotes much of his concurring opinion to suggesting that, look, he would decide this, I think, based solely on the historical evidence, and he really thinks stare decisis is sort of overdone, mm-hmm. you know, and given too much weight. And he uses part of his opinion to kind of ridicule the idea. And he says that if the court got something wrong, the court shouldn't worry about fixing it and should just go ahead and do it. And certainly there have been plenty of precedents in the area of same-sex marriage and elsewhere that have fallen in recent years that the Supreme Court seemed to have reached an opposite conclusion on previously.
Yeah. Let me just jump in here, Josh, for a second, because, I mean, ostensibly, in terms of the honoring precedent notion, as you put it, if any court can defy precedent, it's the Supreme Court itself that is establishing those precedents. I mean, I'm thinking about last year in the Janus case, right, which was the case where the court ruled that union members weren't compelled to pay those agency fees for in public sector unions. It was a really big case that revolved around an extension of what we believe what the court saw as First Amendment rights. And it's Justice Kagan's searing dissent in this case where she said, you know, the worst part of today of that opinion was that the majority subverted, in her words, all known principles of stare decisis. So the court does this frequently. I mean, is it is just a notion about how important precedent is.
Yeah, I mean, you'll see them pay a lip service to the notions of stability in the law. And there are certainly some justices that I think maybe give that whole principle greater weight or greater import than others. But it does often seem that it's a matter of your perspective in the particular case. And if it's going to prevent you from reaching the result, the legal result that you think is appropriate in the case, you tend to give stare decisis a rather minimal weight, and you view the previous decisions as simply erroneous. And if it's something that's going to help you reach to the decision that you think is right, I'm not saying necessarily politically right, but legally right in a particular case, those justices seem to embrace stare decisis and sing its praises from the mountaintop. So it does lead to a certain degree of cynicism, I think, on the part of court watchers and court reporters like me to see the principle embraced only when it's sort of convenient for justices to do so.
So, Ian Farrell, given that, is it significant that Justice Thomas, as Josh was noting, in his concurrence, seems to be laying the ground to say, meh, you know, stare decisis, convenient when we need it, not convenient when we don't want it?
Yeah, I think Josh is exactly right to point to Justice Thomas's concurrence. And what struck me about Justice Thomas's concurrence is that his discussion of precedent was entirely irrelevant to his conclusion. He starts his opinion by pointing out that according to the original meaning of the Constitution, it is absolutely clear that the dual sovereignty principle is in fact part of the Constitution. And so all of the precedents, according to Justice Thomas, are correct. Mm-hmm. And so there is no need for him, in support of his argument, to talk about overturning precedents. And so the fact that he devotes a large portion of his concurrence to a screed against precedent and the way that the court currently treats precedent is very telling. And also telling is, as part of this discussion and criticism of the way courts treat earlier precedents, is he says that the court has tended to respect precedents the most when they should be respected the least. And those cases, he says, are the substantive due process cases, i.e. the cases that should be given the least respect are the cases that came up with, for instance, Roe v. Wade.
I see. Well, Ian Farrell, he teaches constitutional law at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. Thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Farrell.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
And Josh Gerstein, senior legal affairs contributor to Politico. Josh, it's always great to have you. Thank you so very much.
Thanks, Meghna. Happy to do it.
Well, when we come back, we'll take a look at a couple of the other big cases that the court has decided and has yet to decide, including on gerrymandering and that citizenship question on the census. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cunio was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country, but it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's take a look at some of the other key cases on the Supreme Court's docket for the remainder of the hour, especially cases around gerrymandering and that citizenship question on the United States 2020 census. And joining me now from Washington is David Savage, Supreme Court correspondent for the LA Times. He's been writing about all these cases, and you can find links to his reporting at onpointradio.org. David, welcome back.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, let's talk about these gerrymandering cases, because I think we have two of them, one regarding racially gerrymandered district and then extreme partisan gerrymandering. So first of all, about racially gerrymandered districts in Virginia, the court just recently issued its decision on that. What happened there?
Well, they basically said the Virginia House Republicans, they do not have standing to challenge a federal court order. The federal court said that about 11 of the districts, this is the state legislature, were racially gerrymandered, and the state has to redraw the districts. The state of Virginia said, fine, it's now under Democratic control. The attorney general said, fine, we will do that. We're not going to appeal. The House Republicans said, okay, we want to appeal. We're not fine with that. And the Supreme Court said, no, you're one house of the legislature. You don't speak for the state. The state attorney general and the governor speak for the state, so they basically threw out the appeal. So this was not actually a ruling on the substance of racial gerrymandering. It just left stand a federal court order to say, redraw these 11 districts.
I see. Okay. So does that mean that the ruling from the Supreme Court does not have any effects on, or potentially any other effects on other states?
Correct, except okay. On the standing issue. Because the Supreme Court has basically said in the past that if the districts were drawn predominantly for racial reasons, they're unconstitutional. They said that over a long time. It's a hard rule to enforce. But so the Supreme Court stuck by that rule, hasn't changed the rule. This just allows it to take effect in Virginia.
I see. Okay. So the other case, which we haven't yet seen the decision, I believe, is about partisan gerrymandering. Can you remind us of what the basis of that case is?
Well, the North Carolina case, which is the main one they have, was unusual in the sense partisan gerrymandering is not a new thing. As you know, it's been around for decades, particularly since 2010 when the Republicans won big in the midterm elections. A whole series of closely divided states, Ohio, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Wisconsin, the Republicans sort of took control, wrote election maps that were very favorable to the Republicans. In North Carolina, it's a 10-3 break, 10 Republicans, 3 Democrats. And the Republican leaders basically admitted, we're doing this for partisan reasons. We want to elect, we want to make sure we have a lopsided majority of Republicans. A lower court struck that down, said it was unconstitutional. You're depriving Democratic voters of an equal vote.
Mm-hmm.
They were only going to have 3 representatives in the House. The problem is the Supreme Court has never struck down an election map on the grounds that it was too partisan, too political. They've struggled with this for years. They've sort of said, we don't like this, but they've never found a way, they've never found a rule. How do you know when it goes from being a little bit political to too political? The North Carolina case seems like a great, it's the real test for the next decade on whether the Supreme Court is going to limit partisan gerrymandering, or in 2021, states are on their, if the politicians have a majority for their party, they can do anything they want to draw an election map that will favor their side.
So David, just to be clear, North Carolina being one of the places where this partisan gerrymandering is being tested at the high court, but there's also a similar Maryland case, right? Are they being considered together?
They are being considered together. The Maryland case is an extreme example, but it involves only one district. The Maryland Democrats changed one district, shifted a bunch of voters around to turn it from a Republican to a Democratic district. The Supreme Court agreed to hear them together. It's sort of nice to have one where the Republicans were on the winning side and one on the Democrats were the winning side. My guess is they will issue one opinion to cover both cases. In other words, they'll say something about partisan gerrymandering, and it'll apply to both.
Interesting. Okay. So we're still awaiting those decisions, but on this topic of gerrymandering, let's just quickly go to Nate, who's calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Nate, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me. I was going to say that at least in North Carolina, they probably, because they were having to testify, were honest that they were trying to rig the elections in their party's favor. Here in Wisconsin and some of the other states, the Republicans are basically trying to say one thing in public and keep everything else behind closed doors, where if you do get access, it'll show what they're thinking. Here in Wisconsin, our Republican Speaker of the Assembly, State Assembly, is trying to dodge having to testify, probably for that very reason.
Yeah. Well, Nate, thank you so much for your call. Well, obviously, we'll try to take a closer look at what happens with those gerrymandering cases as and when the court decides them. But David Savage, I also wanted to explore with you the Department of Commerce versus New York State. This is the Supreme Court case about that citizenship question that the federal government wants on the 2020 census. So remind me, what's the basis of the challenge that New York has brought against the Department of Commerce?
Oh, they basically said that you're making a big change. You, Wilbur Ross, are making a big change in the census at the last minute, and you have not come up with a valid reason. You've defied the census experts who said, hey, if you add this citizenship question, millions of people, millions of households, immigrants are not going to respond, and therefore you're going to have a severe undercount. And so the legal argument is this violates federal procedure law, that there's something called the Administrative Procedures Act that says if the government's going to make a change, they have to sort of explain it, have to have a real reason. Wilbur Ross has been very dodgy as to what's, what was the reason for this. A lot of people think it was political. He tried to deny that. But anyway, a lower court blocked it on the grounds that it violated the federal procedure law because the government had, the Commerce Department had no good reason for making this big change.
So this is the looking at the gerrymander, the partisan gerrymandering cases and the census case together. You've written in the LA Times about how these cases may be putting Chief Justice John Roberts, in your words, in an awkward spot. Now, why is that?
Well, John Roberts, for a lot of years and frequently in the last couple of years, has wanted to tell people, we don't work as Democrats or Republicans. We're not here to represent a party. He's worried about the sort of partisan rancor in Washington and wanted to keep the court separate from that. But here's two big cases that involve political power in the decade ahead. One of them, as we said, partisan gerrymandering. The other is the census, the citizenship question, because that's going to determine how many people are counted in various areas and how power is divided up. But they know it's a big political question. And you've got a Supreme Court with five Republican appointees, four Democratic appointees. As I said, John Roberts wants to say, we're not in the business of politics, but if this comes out as 2-5-4 decisions where the five Republican appointees take the view favored by the Republican Party, the Republicans in North Carolina, and the Trump administration, it will sure look to people like, wow, that sure looks very political.
I mean, isn't the court then itself kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place? Because I can imagine that the justices in issuing their decisions, however they go, obviously they're going to be writing extensively about the legal basis for those decisions. But regardless of what that basis is, it sounds like you're saying the public is going to look at what the court does as highly political.
Well, I think the public will see it that way. And you're right. They're good lawyers. They're smart judges. They will have their legal reasons. But in the census case, the legal reason will basically be, it's like the travel ban case last year. If John Roberts has the opinion, he will say, and this is correct, that the law gives quite a bit of deference to the executive branch. It gave President Trump the authority to sort of set conditions for entry to the United States. That's how he could uphold the travel ban. The census law basically gives the Commerce Department a lot of discretion to decide how to do the census. And he'll say, you know, we're just deferring to the Commerce Department. I think the Democratic dissenters, if that's what they are, will say, come on. There's an enormous amount of evidence that this was done for political reasons, not because you wanted a better census count, and the court shouldn't uphold it. So it'll look like there will be legal reasons on both sides,
yeah, but
it'll look very political.
How do you think Justice Kavanaugh might approach this census question? Because he's historically been, you know, very critical of the administrative state, for example.
It's an interesting point, isn't it? They were very... A lot of the conservative judges were very critical of the administrative state during the Obama era, less so now. I think, as I say, that they said this during the oral argument, that the law seems to put the decision-making authority in the hands of the Commerce Department. These are not, you know, they would say, oh, these are not low-level bureaucrats coming up with arcane regulations. This is a big decision that was in the hands of the cabinet appointee Wilbur Ross, and we think the law calls for deferring to his decision.
Yeah. Well, let's take a quick call here on this census issue. Ray is calling from Taos, New Mexico. Ray, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This is a fascinating subject. So if they, if it gets passed that the citizenship question gets added to the census, what would happen if people just didn't answer the question on the census? They just left it blank.
Yeah. So, Ray, I think that, thank you for your call. And I think that's exactly the concern that some people have about it leading to an undercount. David Savage, is that right?
Yes, that is the concern. And it's a good question, Ray. And I know a little bit about not what census people say is, well, we would go back and try again, go back to that house. We would try. Yeah, they will make, I think the Census Bureau will tell you, they will make a lot of efforts to get the right information. But the experts who testified during the trial said there's going to be a significant drop-off in the count, and it's going to be particularly in areas where there's a large number of immigrants. Southern California is one, Texas, all around the country. And those areas tend to favor Democrats, so that people think a lot of people inevitably are not going to respond to that question. There's going to be a drop-off in the count, and that will have political consequences down the road.
So, David, you've written very interestingly about how, again, Chief Justice John Roberts is trying to lead his court in these hyper-partisan times. I mean, you've written that, the chief has made it clear that he would like to avoid 5-4 rulings in some of these very big cases. How does he do that? Does he have the, power to make it seem not as ideologically split as the decisions might be?
If you had him on the line, he would say sort of yes and no. Yes, that he has some. He's been concerned about this since he came on the court, and he talked a lot of early in his years on the court, and he's kept it up. That he thinks the 5-4 big decisions look partisan, they look political. They don't look legal. And so in a lot of cases over the years where it's possible, Roberts would try to find a middle ground position where, say, 6 or 7 of the justices could agree. Sometimes if you focus on something narrowly, you can find a way where a lot of us agree and we can decide something narrowly. So a lot of cases over the years, he's found ways to avoid a 5-4 decision. But then he will say, and it's true, there are certain cases where, and I think the census is one of them, it's essentially a yes-no question. You know, in other words, they either have to say, yes, the government can add the citizenship question, or no, they can't. There's not a lot of wiggle room. There's not a lot of, I think on partisan gerrymandering, they could come up with some middle position that keeps alive these challenges but doesn't decide too much. I think census is a yes or no question, and so in those situations, it's very hard for him to avoid a 5-4 ruling.
David, let me lean on your long experience here covering the court, because regardless of who the Chief Justice is, I feel like there's for quite some time there's been a concern amongst people on both the right and the left that you know, if a liberal judge is put on the court, they might actually move towards a more moderate stance over time, and vice versa, if a deeply conservative judge is put on the court, they might also move to a more moderate stance. Are we seeing that happening in the Roberts Court as it evolves, or have the justices been fairly predictably partisan?
Well, I'd say predictably partisan on the left. That's probably not the best word, but I would say since about 1990, after David Souter went on the court, you know, he's a sort of famous example of the sort of Republican appointee who was moderate to liberal. Both parties have been much more careful at picking justices who essentially agree with us on all the big issues. And you know what I mean, abortion, affirmative action, those gay rights, those types of issues. And so there's been very little of the, you know, move to the middle, or the conservative judge becoming moderate, or the liberal judge moving to the middle. They have been, at least on the really big issues, pretty predictable.
Well, David Savage, Supreme Court correspondent for the LA Times. We have links to his recent reporting at onpointradio.org. David, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Megna.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, and Grace Tatter, with help from David Marino, Alex Reese, and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Megna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Mm-hmm. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.